The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 148 of The Bugle, the world's one remaining bastion of probity in a world of seismic level f***ery. I am Andy Zaltzman, and in the latest of my trips around the glamour spots of the world, here I am in Wapping, London, the area frequented by celebrities such as Hollywood film star Cary Grant, legendary baseballer Babe Ruth, the singer and sex symbol Marlene Dietrich, and the ex-Russian number one Peter the Great, all of them possibly molecules from their bodies currently residing in Wapping. We don't know. We don't know either way. Anyway, joining me from New York, it's the man described by former heavyweight boxing champion Joe Frazier as some chump I'd have knocked Spark out in under 10 seconds. It's John Fists of Fury Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, amigos. We're back, Andy, and, well, most importantly, you're back, yep. Andy. And has your lassie intake gone down dramatically over the last week?
It has.
Are you trying to wean yourself off it?
It's been tough, John. It's been tough not having doses for breakfast every day. You know, I wouldn't want anyone to go through what I've been through this week, John.
Now, Andy, tell me this. When you're wandering around the next colony, what emotions do you feel deep down? Is it guilt at all the terrible ways that we behaved in history? Or do you think, do you know what? Yeah, I can see why we did it. Nice place. I'd put a railway there, I'd put a massive hedge there, and that looks like a lovely spot to open fire on a crowd of unarmed people. Yes, I can see the charm, and just for the record, je ne regrette rien.
Well, it was a bit like, I had this incident after the final, John. Around the streets of Mumbai, there were scenes of absolutely wild celebration of, probably, I don't know how many people on the streets, but hundreds of thousands around the ground and presumably elsewhere around the city. And they were mostly extremely good-natured and as ludicrously overexcited as you would expect. But anyway, this one guy came past and leaned out of a crowded taxi and just shouted out at me, "Go home, white man, go home." And had he stopped for a chat, I'd have pointed out that that was, you know, going on for 65 years late, that request. And
but it was, you know, it was true then.
Yeah. I mean, he had a fair point, albeit a slightly out-of-date point. And he didn't look old enough to be still making it. But the other alternative theory I came up with was that I was actually due to leave the next day, and it was merely someone from the airline reminding me that I had a flight to catch the following day.
But both are possible.
Yeah. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of particular grudge against the British, and not everything.
That's surprising.
Not everything we did there was opening fire on crowds of unarmed natives, John. Mm-hmm. So let's get this in perspective.
That's true.
But it was fascinating place, and I guess also the thing is when you've got India and Pakistan next to each other, they both have slightly forgotten about the British in their priority list of people to have grudges against. So in the soundproof safe this week, back after being sent to have some extra air holes drilled in it after the unfortunate incidents with Madeleine Albright and the Vandellas. Doesn't matter now, they're all fine, but the tour is off, I repeat. Madeleine and the Vandellas are not touring as planned this summer, although some of the dates are being filled in by Lawrence Eagleburger and the Supremes. Anyway, in the soundproof safe this week is the recently defected ex-Libyan foreign minister, Moussa Koussa, who will be telling us how he revolutionised the way Libyans think about shelving and singing from his forthcoming album of disco classic, Moussa Sings the 70s. And later in this show, we'll be showing you how to tape a wriggling dog to a table leg during an important business meeting, how to multitask by booking a holiday during a funeral, and how to ensure your doddery old relatives never get lost by slapping a £25,000 reward on them. No section in the bin from this week's audio newspaper, instead a section that's been nicked by someone before you could get your hands on it, because it looked interesting whilst the rest of the Bugle didn't really grab the attention. And it's a science section, including the latest disproved theories, including if you throw an agnostic child at the wall, it sticks, unless it's the church wall, in which case it rebounds at increased velocity. Also disproved is the theory that if you stand up to your waist in a tank of Coca-Cola, your legs become stripy and furry like a zebra's legs. And also if you pour blue copper sulfate solution over the pages of a Jane Austen novel, it turns red. Damn communist bitch.
Top story this week, Mayhem Update! Well, it's been 3 weeks since we last did a proper Bugle, and what a 3 weeks it's been. It's very much been like a Ukrainian sausage, absolutely stuffed full of unpleasantness. And we have a break.
Take that, the Kielbasaur industry.
If we have a break for 3 weeks again, Andy, and similar world events take place, I think we need to seriously consider never taking another bugle off. I just could not have it on my conscience. Now, some people choose to spend non-bugle weeks by getting on with their lives, but I know that some other people prefer to hibernate rather than engage with the world, pack themselves into a box stuffed with straw, poke out a couple of air holes, get cosy with a water dish and some carrots to keep them going, only coming out when the next true bugle is ready. And to them I say this: welcome back! Welcome back! The world is absolutely fine now! Everything's okay again! Just kidding! I'd get back in the box if I was you and give the world another few weeks to sort its shit out. Because when we left, Colonel Gaddafi was clinging onto power like a donkey clinging onto a Spanish clock tower. Well, now he's still clinging onto power, but this time his grip resembles a donkey grabbing the Spaniard that tried to throw him off by the throat. What I'm saying is, Gaddafi is like the Japanese nuclear waste. He's still around, he's potentially more dangerous than ever, and you really don't want to be anywhere near him right now.
Well, I've been doing my best to ignore Libya as well whilst we've had our couple of weeks off. And to be honest, when I was in India, it was pretty easy to ignore him because in the build-up to and aftermath of the semi-final between India and Pakistan that we just talked about, as far as I and everyone else in the region was concerned, there were no other things happening in the entire universe. It was, without question, the most important thing ever to happen on this planet, without a doubt. It made the Industrial Revolution look like a mother's meeting by a duck pond, and it made the First World War seem like a European Amateur Boxing Championships middleweight quarter-final. So, for any American listeners struggling to understand the magnitude of this game, imagine America versus Canada at pancake-making, and then multiply it by quite a lot. So it's sort of hard to think too hard about Gaddafi and his latest bouts of f***ery, or NATO's Bomb a Bit and Hope for the Best campaign, which followed on, of course, from its Frown a Lot and Hope for the Best campaign, which had limited success. And as we said on the last bugle, it has been a very good time to be immersed in a fun but essentially meaningless cricket tournament.
Libya is still in a state of real chaos. Gaddafi has lost support of most of the country. The problem seems to be that the rebels have absolutely no organisational skills whatsoever. Reports have emerged over the last couple of weeks of rebels even mistakenly firing RPG missiles the wrong way, aiming at Gaddafi loyalists and instead firing backwards towards civilian areas. Also, NATO yesterday mistakenly bombed rebels themselves, mistaking them for Gaddafi forces with tanks, apparently killing 13 people. It is a slapstick civil war, this, Andy, except instead of foam cannons and banana skins, it's lots and lots of blood. It's like an early Woody Allen film, except instead of being funny, it's just depressing and harrowing. So in some ways, it's like a late Woody Allen film. It's hard.
Zing! Take that!
It's hard to think of nice things to say about Gaddafi.
Did he not like the Love Guru? Is that what that's about? Is that a score settling thing?
He didn't understand it. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say he didn't get it. I don't know if he liked it or not. I sure know he didn't understand it. I guess you could say about Gaddafi, if you're trying to think of something nice to say, he's outspoken. He has flamboyant taste in hats,
yep.
And he has undeniable staying power, because other dictators had packed up and gone by now, but not the G-Man. He is a lunatic limpet, Andy, a crazy carbuncle who has welded himself to Tripoli. None of the recent defections by high-profile members of his inner circle seem to have bothered him at all. In fact, so far, his only offer to rebels was rumoured to be that he would step down from power, but would take the role of monarch instead. While his son Saif took power, the ironically named Saif Gaddafi, or not remotely Saif Gaddafi, to give him his full passport name.
Well, as you said, the rebel campaign has been sort of rather ad hoc, kind of last-minute hacking together of whatever was available, which I think was also a review I once had for one of my Edinburgh shows. But but there's been some debate over whether we in the West should be arming the rebels, and would that constitute interfering in a sovereign nation's...
Right.
Civil disagreements, or whether that would just constitute balancing things out. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we have to give them the same $300 million worth of arms that we've been giving Gaddafi every year, backdated, say, 5 years, just to even things up a bit. But maybe at least some free pairs of stockings to try to turn into slings, or maybe some gardening three-pronged pitchforks that can be turned into two twang catapults. You know, just to even it up a little bit and make it more of an even contest for the neutral. But every time I watch the news from Libya, John, I cannot help thinking to myself, oh, we f***ed up big time. Our efforts to aid the rebels, which, as you said, have not gone too smoothly over the last couple of days. They've been sort of so ham-fisted that top Italian chefs have been hovering around NATO headquarters with some very sharp knives, hoping to serve thin slices of NATO hand in their restaurants. And even if they had gone unimprovably smoothly, it would still represent the equivalent of buying a new mid-range jacket for a man who you had just released into a lion enclosure at feeding time, covered in zebra ketchup.
One of the things most of the world and almost all of the Libyan people are certainly wondering at the moment is, how long can Gaddafi keep this up? He's certainly burning through money. Early on in the rebellion, his government gave away 400 dinars, that's £250, to every family, and promised to raise salaries by up to 150%. Some loyalists in Tripoli were given as much as 17,000 dinars, a new car and a weapon. Although they must have known that the first two gifts were very much contingent on the acceptance of the third gift there. And the foreign mercenaries fighting for Gaddafi, of which there are reportedly thousands, were reportedly being paid as much as $10,000 to sign on, with a daily wage of up to $1,000. And that is a lot to bankroll indefinitely. And sure, Gaddafi has probably plundered a decent amount of money over his four decades in power. And sure, Libya has gigantic gold reserves to delicately complement its massive oil reserves. But can Gaddafi really trust himself to spend that money on his own militia and not fritter it away on more crazy private Beyoncé concerts? He's his own worst enemy, Andy, as well as the people of Libya's worst enemy.
Well, apparently, and this is an interesting development, that Kelly Rowland has sided with the rebels and her and Beyoncé are going to have a sing-off to next weekend to try and help resolve the issue.
One of the concerns the international community clearly and understandably has surrounding the rebels themselves specifically is, who the f*** are these people? Are they the standard fare death to America rebels? Or are they more like the Egyptian Facebook hipsters? Do they think that America is the great Satan or, you know, an acceptable Satan? Well, because the thing is, we knew who the Egyptian protesters were. There was the Google guy crying on TV. It was the Facebook revolution. The problem is that we only see Libyans now diving for cover as rockets narrowly miss them on TV. Are they on Tumblr? Are they on Twitter? Have they learnt nothing from the Arab Spring, Andy? You have to use social media. Get all your frustrations and dreams from the last four decades out and communicate them in 140 characters or less. Also, America is very, very keen to point out that this is not a war. It is not a war. Sure, it might seem a little war-ish, a little war-esque at times, you know, what with the planes and the bangs and the explosions. Now, I can see how someone could make the mistake of thinking it was a little war-y. But they would be wrong, Andy, because this is, in the words of Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes, a kinetic military action. How can he say those words with a straight face? You have to believe that when Ben Rhodes got home that night and Mrs. Rhodes asked him how his day at work was, he just looked straight at her and said, it was f***ing terrible. I don't want to talk about it.
Are there any military actions that are not kinetic in some way?
It's so stupid.
Are there any that involve just standing still? As maybe, I guess, trench warfare. That is non-kinetic military action, I guess.
Yeah, that's right, for most of the time.
I heard the official NATO classification of this conflict is negotiative argy-bargy. So, yeah, there's something to work on for the lawyers.
America insists that instead of a war, instead of the war that it resembles in sight, sound, smell and touch, it's how it feels. This war that isn't a war that matters the most. It's actually an intervention. It's like the international community has staged a drug-style intervention on Gaddafi, surprising him by gathering together and saying, we're all concerned about you. Your behaviour has become increasingly erratic and you've hurt a great number of the people here. This has to stop. Now, Bahrain, Syria and Yemen, all of whom are seeing large, unprecedented protests against their oppressive regimes, could understandably be watching the West's assisting of the rebels against Gaddafi and asking themselves, what has Libya got that we haven't? And, you know, it would be easy for America to answer simply by saying, well, look under your feet. What do you see? Nothing. Exactly. No black viscous liquid. Didn't think so. Good luck with that, Ahmed. But you don't just give away something like freedom for free, you know. Also, those countries in question, Bahrain, Syria and Yemen, unfortunately do not qualify for American assistance due to their poor Saudi scores. Now, the Saudi score is the score assigned to each Arab state based on Saudi Arabia's level of support for the current regime staying in power. Gaddafi has absolutely no support from Saudi Arabia. Therefore, Libya has a very good Saudi score. However, Bahrain has a Sunni government controlling a predominantly Shiite population, which means their protesters have a very poor Saudi score, which means, essentially, they are shit out of luck. And any Arab nation, Andy, this is important to the state, can check their Saudi score online by going to freesaudiscore.com. That will tell them what their score is, and more importantly, what they can do to improve it and have any hope of international assistance for regime change in the future.
Hi, this is Gab Marcotti here. Now, I may not be funny like these freaking court gestures you have here, but this is football. It's a serious game, so it doesn't need jokes. If you want jokes, why don't you f*** off to Football Weekly and go enjoy lots of funny puns? Or hang around with these guys, Oliver and Zaltzman. Yes, they're very, very funny. Anyway, because football, like life, is serious and not something to be laughed at, please join me and some of the world's best pundits every Monday in the Game Podcast, which, of course, as you all know, is another podcast from The Times. No, we're not funny. We don't laugh at people's names. We don't make clever puns. We just tell you about football in a very, very serious way. And I, myself, am especially pedantic in doing so. Think you don't like it? Well, you probably think you don't like S&M or genital torture either. But that's until you've tried it. You can find us on iTunes or at thetimes.co.uk. Now back to what you consider fun.
Government news now. So, what is the state of the democratic system that people are dying for around the world at the moment? Is it even worth it? Or is it a bit like when someone gets killed in a stampede in a toy store for a limited edition Beanie Baby at Christmas? Sure, it seems like a desirable item. Lots of people seem to want it. But is it really worth dying over? Because when you examine it up close, it's quite poorly made and looks like it could fall apart at any second. And the United States is currently not setting the shiniest example to the rest of the world of just how foolproof democracy is. It seems increasingly likely here that there will be a government shutdown after Congress failed yet again to pass a budget. The current deadline is the 8th of April, which is today. And if both the House and the Senate can't pass a budget bill by then, the US government will basically just have to close up shop. Now, whilst government shutdowns are not entirely uncommon here, there hasn't actually been one since 1995, the US government did shut down 10 times during the Carter and the Reagan administrations. The shutdowns happen because an 1870 law prohibits the government from operating if a budget hasn't been passed, except in the case of emergencies. And there are many reasons to not want the US government to shut down. But one is that the last time there was one here, it was in 1995, for 26 days. And during that time, Bill Clinton started his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, leading to an impeachment and one of the smartest presidents in the last 50 years having to piss his last term of office up the wall by answering questions about what constitutes a blowjob. So I really think it might be worth keeping an extra special eye on the key members of the Obama administration, particularly in the groinal department. You do not want lightning to strike all over the same dress twice. The sticking point is over how large the cuts to the budget should be in the current economic climate. Or, in other words, how miserable should the budget make everyone? The Democrats want to cut $33 billion and make people quite miserable. But the Republicans want to cut $61 billion and make people absolutely suicidal. Now, can they not just meet each other halfway, Andy, and agree to make people catatonic with depression? Isn't that what compromise and governance is all about?
So, I mean, what would happen, John, you know, if America does shut down? Could that leave it, you know, vulnerable to a sort of blitzkrieg attack from the Canadian armed forces to try and, regain some lost ground?
There's some... I think true essential workers are supposed to be working, but it can't be a coincidence that almost the entire population of Canada is standing on the Canadian border right now looking very twitchy.
with some scythes and pitchforks.
A government shutdown works by furloughing non-essential government workers, and it must be made of what is actually going to shut down the Washington Monument, museums, the DC Zoo. There was even some gnashing of teeth over the disruption to this weekend's planned cherry blossom parade. But I'll tell you what else will stop, Andy, apart from your ability to see a panda. Cancer research, that will stop, as will processing passport applications, as will the filing of tax returns. Government workers are usually suspended without pay and then later given back pay, even though they'd not worked during that period. So that's the beautiful irony of this whole story, Andy. Shutting down the government is actually f***ing expensive here. Some estimates put the cost of the government shutdowns in 95 and 96 at over $1.25 billion, much of it due to inefficiency. Well, Middle East, look at this. Isn't democracy fantastic?
Obama apparently has urged lawmakers to, quote, act like adults and
good luck.
And bring it. Yeah. Well, I think he's. I mean, this is surely the wrong thing. This is what they are doing. They're acting like adults and that they're completely refusing to back down from views that they held when they were children. And surely he should be encouraging them to act like children, in other words, to respond constructively to simple bribes. Bag of sweets will do it.
And if you think that's bad, then let's spare a thought for Belgium, who have now been without a government for over 280 days, breaking the world record for a country waiting for a government. The record was previously held by Iraq, although let's not rule out Iraq trying to take that record back in the not-too-distant future. And you know, Belgians have reacted appropriately, Andy, by celebrating their world-beating dysfunctional behaviour. They've held events across the country to mark the occasion. Apparently, in Leuven and in Dutch-speaking Flanders, locals handed out free French fries, whilst in Louvain de Neuve and in French-speaking Wallonia, free beer was on offer. Now, good for them, Andy. Now, I'm glad they're celebrating, but I think we're all thinking the same thing. Where the f*** were the waffles there, Andy? Where were the victory waffles? You just broke a world record. Treat yourselves to the only foodstuff everyone else on Earth thinks that you eat. Where were the waffles? In fact, Time magazine, Andy, ran this story last week under this headline, and I quote, Belgian waffling. See? It's not just us. Even a legitimate news source, albeit in a dying medium, cannot resist a waffle joke. It can't be done.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the Germans, the Belgian Stock Exchange. I don't know how the Belgian Stock Exchange has been faring on its one traded commodity, waffle batter. Presumably, prices have been spiralling up. And, you know, that's the problem when you leave your economy so dependent on one simple product that you just don't know what's going to happen. But there's one chap who's out apparently making an inventory of every pub in Flanders. And he's a man called Edmund Cockout. And
what? What?
Andy? Well, Cockout. It's spelled C-O-C. How would you pronounce that, John? Cock. I mean, that's cock, isn't it? Now, and then Q-U-Y-T. Now, the Liverpool footballer, Dirk Kuyt, that's pronounced Kuyt, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this man is, I'm not going to lampoon him for his name, but his name is Edmund Cockout. Let's let's merely leave that as a pronunciative fact. Anyway, he said, our politicians are heroes. We're proud of this. Finally, we can send out a positive message about Belgium. My country is the world record holder. So there you go. And then he said, everything goes on in the same old way. It's better not having a government. Besides, the trouble with democracy is it's so slow. If we want to build a new road, it takes us 20 years to decide. The Chinese dictatorship does it the next day.
Oh,
there you go.
Oh, yes.
Careful what you wish for, Mr. Cockout, because they might build their road the next day, but at the same time, they will monopolise waffle production. And I mean, that, you can't really allow that. In a Western nation.
There are some very, very tightly hidden costs to that road. Hidden human costs. Now, the concern is that Belgium is so divided as a nation that it may actually split. and that their delicately latticed country will break open to reveal a sweet steaming centre. That's right, it's another waffle reference.
Oh dear. Oh. That's John Oliver from the world's leading satirical comedy show.
Sometimes I've just got to relax my brain, Andy. It's been a rough few weeks to be working.
Bugle feature now and Royal Wedding Countdown. We are,
yes,
as you very well know, the official podcast of the Royal Wedding, as appointed by Her Majesty Queen Victoria herself on her deathbed in 1901. She said, I believe, it was amongst her last words, were, other than, can someone turn that f***ing radio off? And I don't need to hear the shipping forecast at this stage of my life. Were, just make sure that the Bugle covers all future royal weddings. So we are the official podcast of the royal wedding. There's just, what were you about?
We're the official podcast, Andy, of the unofficial royal wedding.
There must be another couple called William and Kate getting married on the same day. We will be the official podcast of their wedding, whether they listen
we'll
to this or not. Yep. There's just 3 weeks to go until the big day when Prince William, the number 3 ranked monarch in Britain, marries Kate, the monkey wrench of annihilation, Middleton. Now, doesn't seem the most appropriate nickname that parents have ever given their child now, but she just looked that way when she popped out, and it kind of stuck. Same reason I've always been known as the human aubergine, and why John's family still call him Eleanor Roosevelt. There are precious few signs, though, John, of William snapping to his senses and marrying someone politically expedient for this country, so it appears we're just going to have to suck it up. And preparations for the big day are proceeding apace, a mass airdrop of disappointing canapes over the whole of Britain, all set to go, rain clouds specially seeded with cheap champagne, and Whitney Houston ready to go up in a hot air balloon and sing I Will Always Love You through a giant megaphone at the assembled crowds in London. It's going to be a special day. Is America excited about it, John?
Well, of course they are, Andy. This is, and for good reason, the greatest day in human history is now just 21 days away. The union of the greatest man in the world and the greatest woman in the world in the hope that they can produce the child which will once more lead Britain back to reinstall its empire and take over the planet again. Anything less than that will be a huge failure on that child's head. But that's all in the future. For now, it's all about pomp. And as Jay-Z would put it, Britain is about to be all about big pomping, spending the cheese. And why not? Why not? With the way the world is at the moment, we need to be distracted, Andy.
Spending the cheese.
Yep.
Does it specify?
We're spending a lot of cheese on this wedding, Andy, on this big pomping.
Yeah. Unpasteurised as well. That's really bumps the bills up.
We need to be distracted, and that is why CNN is reportedly sending over 150 people to cover the wedding. In contrast to that, they had 50 people in Japan and virtually no one in Libya. And that's because they know what matters. It's time for us all to stop looking into the abyss and start looking at something shiny instead. This has always been the case, Andy. When things get too depressing in the world, the royal family step forward and one of them gets married. Look at 1981. Reagan was shot, the Pope was shot, AIDS was discovered, apartheid was still going, so Charles and Diana got married so we could all ignore it for a bit. Then, in 1986, Uganda was raging in civil war, 500,000 people were killed, the space shuttle Challenger exploded, there were kidnappings in Beirut, and there was the Chernobyl disaster. Someone clearly had to do something, so Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson got married. It didn't matter that both couples were fatally flawed and terribly incompatible. It was about something bigger than them. They entered terrible marriages so that for just one day, people could be distracted from the world around them.
And let's not forget, in the summer of 1986, the England cricket team lost home series to both India and New Zealand. So, I mean, they were really dark times for this country.
I can't believe I prioritised Chernobyl over that, Andy. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And now there's uprisings in the Middle East, tsunamis in Japan, and we're stepping up to the plate again in Britain. Don't worry, world, we've got this. Break out the crown polisher, we're putting on a show.
There must have been a f*** of lot of problems in the world in the early 16th century, judging by Henry VIII. He was a very public-spirited man. But there is relatively little excitement here, John. There's very few applications for street parties. to be held, compared with certainly the Charles and Diana wedding and the Queen's Jubilee in 1977. I think the reason, there's a number of reasons for this. As a nation, we simply aren't quite as impressed by shiny hats as we used to be. Also, you know, William and Kate didn't come and wave flags at my wedding, so why the f*** do they expect me to do so at theirs? Also, the magic of royalty was destroyed when scientists proved that princesses could only feel a pee under their mattresses if they'd been leaked information about the presence of the pee by court insiders. And also destroyed when Prince Charles still looked like a frog, even after the 1981 royal wedding. So all these myths about royalty sort of fizzled away. And also, if we, the taxpayers and voters, are forking out for it, when we would have preferred the prince's wife to have been democratically elected, or at least for the wife to be randomly selected on the day from 300 lottery winners, which yes. is also how Henry VIII used to do it. And of course, some people in Britain are simply firebrand Republicans who will not rest until the entire royal family are on a one-way train ticket to Siberia again. So I guess that's, you know, we're just not as excited as we might have been. But I'm sure when it comes to your wedding later in the year, that's the one that Britain is really getting yeah, revved up
absolutely.
For, John.
Yeah.
How's the seating plan coming on? Because I want to sit next to Bill Clinton, if that's all right. So I put you on a pretty decent table at my wedding. So okay. I want Clinton, I want Gyllenhaal, yeah. preferably the girl one, and I want Barrès.
The girl one? Who's the third one you want?
Barrès.
He should be out of jail by then. Yeah. That's what we're hoping.
Otherwise, I'm not coming.
That's what we're hoping. Yeah. We do this is the toast has been given by Delonte West as well, Andy.
Right.
$99 wine and dine.
And I heard you've sold the exclusive film and photography rights to Miramax for $30 million.
Yes.
And they've controversially decided to cast Kiefer Sutherland as you and
I think it's very wise.
Queen Latifah as your mother, which you know, it's you know, provocative yeah. casting.
Well, you know, it's eye catching. Easter weekend next year. Your emails now, and we had a great email from Mark Crawley under the subject "Who the hell is Chris?" And he says, "Dear John, Chris, the Buglers, and Ped, in order of who is most likely lying when Andy asked them, was his Zolt's Cricket Twitter account great?" He said, after listening to a not-so-good bullshit show compared to the Bugle, I heard their producer was called Chris in their broadcast, and it got me wondering then if it was the same piss producer as on the Bugle. I decided to do a bit of research and found a site dedicated to the Bugle producer Chris. Why there's a website that's detailing the history about some has-been producer frankly disturbs me to the bone, making me what you will. Well, I had the absolute opposite response when I clicked on this. Basically, if you just type Chris the Bugle producer wiki into Google, there is the most phenomenal work of art, basically detailing the intricacies of the history of Chris's life from 0 to 100 AD. Let's just pick through. Basically, it has some details from the history of his life, and then just a series of Chris facts. And it really is worth looking at. This is a work of art. Chris was, under birth and early life, Chris was born on June the 6th, 006, as a response by the devil to God's new baby boy, Jesus H. Christ.
Fact.
From 0 to 100 AD, it says, Chris's first great atrocity on the race of man was the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Naughty Chris. Naughty Chris.
Fact.
Basically, this goes on and on. So here are some of the Chris facts available. Chris was the first openly gay ruler of Denmark from 1999 to 2003. That's interesting, Chris.
And true.
Yep. Chris says, Chris enforces the blockade on Gaza against the will of the Israeli military.
Also true.
Chris once sucked all the protein out of a rhino.
Chris, not Helen, was responsible for the Trojan War. He chatted up Paris in a club and the poor kid fell for his charms. Unfortunately, Chris wasn't interested and Paris ended up staging the entire war as an outlet for his angst.
Chris failed utterly to prevent the outbreak of World War II. Well, that is a fact.
Yeah.
That is a stone-cold fact.
Chris has the heart of an angel. He keeps it in a jar on his desk.
I like... Chris went back in time to watch Jesus die just for kicks and giggles. He kicked Jesus and giggled like a little girl.
Well, Well, you might like this one as well. Chris once rented a baby to show off at one of the various high-class events he's known to frequent, and then broke its leg and sent it back for a refund. Chris only convinced John to do The Love Guru instead of accepting the lead in The Dark Knight, telling him that that Batman thing is over.
Sorry, John.
Chris voted for Bush in the 2004 US election over 300 times.
All in Florida, yeah.
Whenever, this was my favourite, whenever Chris buys groceries, he deliberately pays 10 pence less than the actual price in order to start an argument. Chris likes nothing more than watching endangered animals frolic freely and happily in their natural habitat in the African savannah through the sight on his rifle.
Chris has no reflection. There you go.
Most of this is true. Most of it.
And also, which is an interesting revelation, something I've certainly not picked up on in the couple of years I've been working with you, Chris has C-cup breasts. Well, keep me pretty well taped up.
Andy, my eyes are here, Andy.
Oh, my God, there's a whole Tom one as well. Holy shit!
I think we'll have to save that for next week. Do we have similar pages of bullshit, John?
I don't think so.
So, do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk, and thanks for those of you who pointed out that you can still contribute to my daughter's sport relief fundraising efforts from this time last year. And, in fact, next week she is doing her mini marathon for this year. And when I say it, the emphasis is very much on the mini there. I believe it's another obstacle course around the nursery school playground. So I'll give you the full details. We're going to see if we can crack last year's fundraising efforts next week. Sport now! And it's the Grand National this weekend. Tomorrow, as we record, this is Bugle 148, and appropriately, a load of horses will run for it. Okay, so it's a huge horse race, John. I'm sure you miss it a lot being over in America. And but it has lost a bit of its unique edge since they neutered some of the fences a few years ago after too many horses ended up being served in local French restaurants as the last-minute special of the day. And but to try and bring back some of that fatal excitement, they've introduced some new fences to the Grand National course this year to add some more dangers to what had become little more than a pony trek through a car park, including the fourth fence is now the Brigadier's Tail Hoover. It's a new fence which looks simple from the front, but in the ditch on the far side, there is a series of giant vacuum cleaner nozzles that suck the horses by the tail back towards the ditch. Any horse that doesn't clear the fence sufficiently could be easily cleaned up. The 12th is now known as Guy Fawkes Glory, another simple-looking fence, but when the galloping horses run over the new motion sensors 15 metres before the fence in the Aintree turf, they will trigger the launch of fireworks from beside the fence. Jockeys will then have to control their easily startled mounts to prevent them bolting off into the crowd in terror. And the 17th is now known as Flipping Heck. It's a new obstacle, a fence hanging down from a bar 5 feet off the ground. At random intervals, the bar and the fence flip over, and the fence now becomes a floating barrier 5 feet off the ground. Jockeys have to decide, do they risk jumping over, or do they wait and run under? An intriguing tactical nuance to the mid-stages of the race. Some form tips this year. The Grand National has never been won by a Uruguayan in a year ending in one. The last time the Grand National was run in the same year as sizable anti-government protests in both Bahrain and Syria, the winning horse was the only one with shaved legs, so this could be a year to put your money on lady horses. And also, there are three Jewish horses in the Grand National this year, but Jewish horses have tended to struggle ever since rabbi jockeys were banned on health and safety grounds in the 1920s. So I would suggest backing one of the Gentile horses in this race. So that's about it for the Bugle this week. Do come and see me at the stand in Glasgow on Sunday the 10th, or Edinburgh on Tuesday the 12th.
So, what a club. What a comedy club, Andy.
Terrific clubs. So, although I haven't... I did my first gig back in the country yesterday night, John, in Potter's Bar, which is not quite as glamorous as it sounds. Doesn't seem to be quite a lot of... Didn't seem to be that much pottery going on, certainly. And... I was a little bit rusty, John, and it turns out that I sell better in Dhaka than Potter's Bar, certainly. So, I've hopefully cleaned out the cobwebs. Ready for Glasgow and Edinburgh. I'll see you all there, buglers, all of you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye!